Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 253 for May 16th, 2010. Coming up in a few minutes.
Men will always ask me the questions that they were too ashamed or embarrassed to ask another man for possibly loss of face. And I've had more men coming to me saying, do you know what, Annabelle, could you just answer this one thing for me? I've never understood it. You know, and Bob's your uncle. We clear it up.
That's Annabelle Meikle, a sensory whiskey expert at Glenmorangie and one of the noses on the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's tasting panel. We sat down to talk a few weeks ago at Whiskey Live New York, and our conversation covered everything from the Society's unique tasting notes to the role of women in the whiskey business. That's coming up later, along with the calendar of events, the emails of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First, though, let's take a look at the week's news brought to you by Glenmorangie. There's a second coming of Supernova on the horizon. Art Begg announced this week that the second edition of Supernova will be released on May 31st. This time around, the peat levels remain the same, but the ABV has been jacked up to 60.1%. The release date comes 2 days after Ardbeg's day at the Isla Festival of Malt and Music. In fact, this is the final Whiskey Cast episode before I leave for Isla. I'll be at the distillery on May 29th and hope to be able to taste the new Supernova that day. In the meantime, you can find my tasting notes for the original Supernova on the Whiskey Cast website and the Whiskey Cast iPhone app sponsored by the Glenrothes. I'll have more details on the plans for my Phase Isle coverage in a few minutes. In April of last year, I was in Toronto for the Spirit of Toronto Festival. On the way home, I stopped off at Kittling Ridge Distillery, along with Johanna and Charles from the Spirit of Toronto, Dave Broom of Whiskey Magazine, and retired Diageo Master Distiller Mike Nicholson. While John Hall was showing us around his warehouse, we noticed some barrels labeled Canadian Oak, and John hinted that those might yield something interesting down the road. We're down the road now. Those casks will be the foundation for his 40 Creek Confederation Oak Whiskey to be released this fall. The oak comes from trees about 40 miles from the distillery that were more than 150 years old. If you contact the distillery by June 23rd, you can pre-order a bottle and reserve your own bottle number between 3 and 16,800. Bottles number 1 and 2 are John's. There's a link at the WhiskeyCast website for more details. Last time around, I mentioned the results of McTeer's spring whiskey auction in Glasgow. Bonhams will hold its next whiskey auction in Edinburgh, June 16th. The highlight will be a 1937 Glenfiddich single malt that was aged for 64 years. It's estimated to sell for as much as $30,000. Maker's Mark is known for its red wax on the bottle. 2 years ago, the distillery released special election-themed bottles with red, white, and blue wax. Now Maker's is releasing a special three-bottle package. Each of the bottles is dipped with either red, white, or blue wax. The package is designed to honor U.S. military members. It should be at retailers in time for Memorial Day. And that's the week's news, brought to you by Glenmorangie Single Malt Whiskey, handcrafted by the 16 Men of Tain since 1843. If the volcanic ash permits, I'll be flying to Scotland on Thursday night for the start of Phase Isle this weekend. The festival's distillery days get underway Saturday at Lagavulin and continue throughout the week. If all goes well, listen for the first Phase Isle episode from Lagavulin Saturday evening Isla time. I'll be producing a new episode every day during the festival, with two on Thursday. That's because Kilhoman and Jura share a day during the festival. I've already heard from several listeners who are planning to be on Isla during the phase. I'm hoping to meet as many listeners as possible. Given the size of the island, I figure we'll keep running into each other over the course of the week. Once again, I'd like to thank all of the 9 distilleries on Isla and Jura. All 9 teamed up to underwrite the costs of producing this special series of episodes. It would not have been possible without their support. Time now for the emails of the week brought to you by the Singleton of Glendullen. I got an email from Thomas Witter in Austria that I'd really like to address. He writes, I've been listening to your podcast for some time now, and I like it very much. However, there are 2 issues that I would like to write you about. Number one, a few months back, the week's cast was almost always available on Sundays in Europe, which I loved. Now it doesn't arrive until Monday, when time is much more limited. I often end up listening to the cast a week late. Number two, I think you're overdoing the commercials. Having worked as a journalist myself, I understand the importance of all that, but what you are doing for Highland Park to me is clearly too much, since you are no longer staying neutral. The plane sponsorships which you mentioned seem much better to me, Lefroy, etc. Still, it's my one and only podcast. Thomas, I really appreciate your note, and I do understand your concerns, and I wanted to address them in this public forum since there are others who may share your feelings. First off, I usually produce each week's episode on Saturday night's U.S. time. Over the last few weeks, I've had some charity events that my family was involved with on the weekends, so some of those episodes were delayed until Sunday night, or in one case a couple of weeks ago, Monday. I do my best to meet my self-imposed deadline of Saturday night, but there are occasions when that's going to slide a little, and I'm sorry for that. I'll try to do better. As for the concern over ads, it is true that I've added several new sponsors in the last couple of months. I've not said this before on the show, but I was a victim of a newsroom staffing cutback last year, and until I find a new full-time media job, WhiskeyCast has sort of become my career, so I've had to seek out new advertisers. As for the specific comment about Highland Park, I think Thomas's concern is over the tagline, which reads, "Highland Park, the most respected single malt whiskey in the world." Click on the Highland Park banner at the WhiskeyCast website and join the inner circle to find out why. Now, I was a Highland Park drinker long before it joined the roster of WhiskeyCast sponsors. But the tagline was written by the folks at Edrington Group, which owns Highland Park, and it refers to statements by other whiskey writers, including F. Paul Packelt, who has often cited the Highland Park 18-year-old as the best spirit in the world in his Spirit Journal. I do my best to remain neutral, and I try to minimize any perceived or actual conflicts of interest. For instance, we're going to hear from Glenmorangie's Annabelle Meikle in a few minutes. Glenmorangie is a sponsor, but the decision to do that interview was entirely mine, and I've never been pressured by an advertiser to feature it in a segment on WhiskeyCast. In fact, I make potential sponsors aware before they ever sign on that they'll get no influence over the editorial content of the show. In the interests of transparency, though, if I do receive financial support from a sponsor for a special episode, I'll acknowledge it, much as I did a couple of minutes ago with the Faye's Isle series. Thomas, I hope I've been able to resolve your concerns, along with anyone else who may share them. And if you ever have a question or a concern about a perceived conflict of interest, or anything else for that matter, please feel free to contact me. I'll answer you honestly and completely. We may have to agree to disagree, but I'm always ready to discuss it. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. You can also reach me through the WhiskeyCast Facebook page or my Twitter feed. This time around, the emails of the week are brought to you by the Singleton of Glendullen, 12-year-old Speyside single malt Scotch whiskey, aged in both American bourbon oak and European sherry oak casks. Still a couple of weeks left to sign up for the Visit Scotland sweepstakes at the WhiskeyCast website. You could win a trip or two from the U.S. or Canada to Glasgow for Whiskey Week this September, including round-trip travel on Iceland Air, lodging, and tickets to Whiskey Live Glasgow. The entry deadline is May 31st. I'm also giving away two books to a couple of lucky subscribers to the WhiskeyCast email newsletter on May 31st. One will win a copy of The Kentucky Bourbon Cookbook by Chef Albert Schmid, who was on the last episode of WhiskeyCast. The second winner gets a copy of Ian Buxton's The Enduring History of Doers. All you have to do is sign up for the monthly newsletter at the WhiskeyCast website. I promise you won't get any spam if you do. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Lefroig. I've mentioned the Islay Festival of Malt and Music already. It gets underway May 22nd and runs through May 30th on Islay. But Whiskey Live Singapore is on May 24th. Canadian Mist's Science Behind the Cocktail Tour visits Tampa May 27th. Milroy's of Soho in London will host a tasting of whiskeys from around the world May 28th. And the second annual Whiskey and All That Festival will be May 29th in Ayr, Scotland. The Wild West Whiskey Fest is June 5th and 6th in Kortrijk, Belgium. Woodford Reserve holds its final Bourbon Academy class of the year June 12th at the distillery in Versailles, Kentucky. And the Kentucky Bourbon Festival's Frankfurt Sampler is that same night. Finally, the Whiskey Guild hosts a tasting and dinner cruise in Philadelphia June 17th. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click on the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla. I'll be checking my plot out this coming weekend. I've been wanting to talk with Annabelle Meikle for a couple of years now. As I mentioned earlier, she's a member of the tasting panel for the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society and helps choose the single cask bottlings that are made available to society members. She's also a key member of the whiskey team at Glenmorangie and spends a lot of her time teaching people about whiskey. We finally connected last month at Whiskey Live New York, and I asked her how she broke into the whiskey business.
Very lucky break. I was working in a delicatessen with a great group of friends. One of them went down to work at the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society. She said to me, "Annabelle, you've got to come down. This is a beautiful place to be. You're going to love the malt whiskey." I took a bit of coaxing. I went down and I thought, this is interesting. And I started off working behind the bar, serving drinks, serving whiskey, serving single malt whiskies and making sandwiches. And then very luckily, within a month's time, the person who was helping out with the events left, and my good friend said to my soon-to-be boss, "I think you should put Annabelle in this job." And sure enough, I bobbed into it and I became an events manager. And within the first month of me working at the Scotch Malt, they gave me the most wonderful training at the whiskey school, which was taken by Jim Swan, who we described as the Obi-Wan Kenobi of the whiskey world. And that was really how I cut my teeth on whiskey.
Another graduate of the Jim Swan School.
Yes, indeed. I was very, very lucky. And, you know, it was amazing because it was a world I had never sort of put my toe in the water with. And the minute I did put my toe in the water, I was kind of embraced by people who knew about whiskey and who wanted to share what they knew. And I think that's the legacy of the whiskey world, is that it encourages people to come in and learn about it and understand about it. And I was spending weekends trekking off to whiskey distilleries, and I suddenly thought, wow, this is an amazing setup. I love it.
Did you have any family history in the business before?
None whatsoever, except that my mother dated David MacDonald of the Glenmorangie Company when she was 17. But that's about it. My father only learnt how to drink whiskey when he was a young man, and he met my mother. And my grandfather would only have Glenmorangie in the house. So obviously the first malt that he drank was Glenmorangie. And he would pour himself a large dram when he got home. He was a busy consultant surgeon. I was a wee girl. I got the first bedtime story. I used to dip my finger into his dram. And that was how I got a taste for it. It's probably a little underage, but...
It was responsible, though, just a finger touch.
It was, yes.
How did you develop your nose?
Oh, I don't know if you develop your nose. I had no idea that I had a reasonably good sense of smell until I was working at the delicatessen and I was doing a wine tasting with one of the wine writers, and I was actually pouring the wines, but every time he said, "Now, what do you smell?" to the audience, and people who know me will know that I, you know, pipe up. And so I kept on piping up with aromas and stuff. And he was kind of like, "You're quite good at this." I don't know if you're good or bad. I think it's about practicing. I think your nose is like a muscle in your body. If you work the muscle, you know, you train it, you keep it fresh. I think probably what I have is a way to communicate what I smell. And I think that's half of it, because most of the time when I'm doing a tasting, if I pinpoint certain aromas, people will go, "Oh yeah, you know, I nearly had that. But when you said it, I got it." And it's because they're not used to describing what they smell, because I do it every day. And I think the only other job is probably a perfumier or a sommelier or a pointer dog. You know, you're not used to describing what you smell because your life doesn't depend on it. Mine does. So, I keep practicing.
Is it fair to say that a good nose is natural, or can it be developed if somebody doesn't have a good sense of smell?
I think if you don't have a good sense of smell, it's very difficult to work with that. I've had some people in my audiences that put their nose into five different glasses and say, "I can't smell anything different." And we could be going from Glenmorangie to Ardbeg, and you kind of want to shake them. Most people are not as poor as that, and they have a good sense of smell. And I think if they worked on it, then they would be able to develop it. If they put their noses into everything, you know, that, you know, every food stuff. I know when I walk along a street, I'm going, what does that smell of? Oh, yes, you know. I'm conscious of it all of the time, whereas most people are not conscious of their sense of smell.
One of the things I've done, or at least I've suggested to people when they ask how to develop their nose, is to go to the supermarket, walk through the produce section and sniff the various herbs and the fruits and just sort of take a more enhanced view to what you're walking around and smelling. Is that something that would be logical to do?
Yes, absolutely. And that's what I mean about going off and doing your homework. You know, work that muscle, work it, make it smell things, understand yourself, because it's about building up a vocabulary of what you smell in the same way that a writer would build up the vocabulary of the words that they use. They use more interesting words. For example, if I look at Martin Nuet, Dave Broom's tasting notes, they describe some absolutely wonderful things, and I'm thinking, how do they know exactly the smell of a macadamia nut? Oh, it's because they go out and smell it. And Charlie McLean was the first person that really taught me to refine what you're smelling, because I remember sitting on the panel at the Scotch Malt Whisky Society, and I think it was the first time I was doing it, and I was very timid, and I put my nose into glass, and I said, well, I think I smell some smoke. And Charlie pounced on me and he said, well, what kind of smoke is it, Annabelle? Is it fresh bonfire smoke? Is it stale cigar smoke? Is it peaty smoke? Is it spicy smoke? And, you know, I kind of thought, wow, I don't know. You know, so I had to think about it. And it's about fine-tuning that.
And as you alluded to, you've served on the tasting panel and nosing panel for the Scotch Malt Whisky Society. That has to be somewhat intimidating for somebody who's never done it before to sit in with people like Charlie McLean and try to nose whiskies with him, right?
Yes, and I'm just laughing because I think that inexperience and that innocence probably protected me. I had no idea what I was letting myself in for. But the fascinating thing about when you work with the panel is they come from a variety of different backgrounds. So one of the panel members will always describe things as aldehydes, estery, you know, very clinical. Then you've got somebody like Charlie who talks in very hedonistic terms. And somewhere you begin to sort of find your own path. But it's interesting because I then sat on another panel years later with Charlie and we tasted all the whiskies blind. And then you look at your notes at the end of it. And Charlie and mine were always very, very similar. So I think that if somebody's taught you how to nose and describe whiskey, you tend to kind of lock on to their style. And certainly Charlie and I, we either pick up the same things or we just happen to describe them in the same way. But yeah, I was very naive, and thank goodness I was, because if I'd really let myself know the lion's den that I was walking into, I think I would have been much more apprehensive. And nosing is so instinctive. You know, I always say to people, never think too much about what you're smelling. It's always the first thing that comes into your head, which is right.
One of the things that makes that panel unique is the tasting notes that come out of it. You've described as somebody will come up with very hedonistic notes like Charlie does, and then someone will come up with very clinical notes. How does the panel translate those into some of the things that we get, that a whiskey that smells like a diver's wetsuit or something like that? How do you translate those into such unusual notes?
Well, I think the whiskies themselves sort of lead that, because they are extraordinary whiskies that we choose for the panel of the Scotch Malt Whisky Society. So what we're always looking for is the unusual, the fascinating, the intriguing note within that. And what we also try and do is create an atmosphere around the whiskey. And, you know, one of the games I like to play with an audience is sometimes is to get them to put their nose into whiskey and describe it as a person or a season or a party. You know, get them to make it into a picture, because if you make something into a visual picture in your mind, it creates all sorts of sort of characteristics. And that's what we try to do at the Whiskey Society. So although you may not have ever smelt, you know, one of the best notes was a wet rubber suit with orange oil on it. Now, how many people know what that smells like? But it immediately makes something very evocative to you. One of my classics was licking a battery. And everyone looked at me on the panel and went, what, you've licked a battery? And I was like, oh, yes, yes.
We all have. We all did 9-volt batteries as kids. Everybody did it at least once.
Yes, and never again. Yeah. Yeah. So I won't mention which whiskey that referred to. But, yeah, it kind of gets you into the mood, and we like to be creative. We like to be stimulating. But the whiskeys are really what drive that.
Now, I also want to get into your role at Glenmorangie, because we all know that it's really you and Rachel that put all the whiskies together. Lumsden really doesn't do a damn thing now, does he?
God, no. I'd quite like to go back to a job, Mark. No.
I am teasing.
Those two are really, really the masters of what we do at Glenmorangie. My role is pretty much out on the road, spreading the good word. You know, I am the archetypal ambassador or evangelist that's going out there while they look after the home fires. But we're a wonderful team, and I think the great balance is those two are chemists, I'm an artist. But we kind of come together with our ideas. And the wonderful thing is, when we come back from all our corners of the world that we come back with, and we put our heads together, is we get this great culmination of creative ideas. And that's the beauty of Glenmorangie, is we're always pushing the boundaries in creating something that's innovative, pioneering. You know, Signet is just a wonderful example of that. Nobody else came up with that idea. Everybody else would have thought you were bonkers if you started talking about making spirit from highly roasted barley. Not Glenmorangie. Always ready to take something on. And that's the joy of working with the team.
Why do women appear to be such better nosers than men? And I know this is a controversial question at times, but it almost seems like many of the really good nosers are women. Why do you think that is?
I think it's not that we're any better. I think it's because we're not embarrassed to use flowery terms, descriptive terms. You know, if you and a group of guys are sitting in a bar, you're not really likely to start talking about, you know, the floral rose petal notes and the soft peachy tones that a whiskey has, are you? You know, it's not the bravado image that whiskey has. Whereas women are much, much more open. I think we've got a much more creative way of describing whiskey. And I think that's where we've seen this kind of this rise in prominence of women in whiskey. I think it's because we're not embarrassed to describe it like a perfume. Whereas a man, it's slightly less likely for him to do that. What do you think?
I always thought, and I see this with my daughters growing up, is that because, for lack of a better descriptor, women spend more time in the kitchen, and are around more spices, more herbs, more fruits, and more different aromas, and figure out how to process those better than guys who don't spend a lot of time in the kitchen for whatever reason. So that's the reason I always thought it. But what you're saying makes some sense about the descriptors, because, well, there are some guys who would not describe a whiskey in flowery terms, but some of us would. But that's the reason I always thought, was that women generally traditionally spent more time in the kitchen and learned to process different aromas, whereas guys, we come into the kitchen and everything smells the same.
I mean, I used to say that, and I still think there's a lot of depth to that argument. You know, if you put a bunch of herbs in front of a woman, she'll probably be able to identify it more accurately. But then you get into all this dangerous territory about all the best chefs in the world are men, so, you know, I could come unstuck on that one.
You mentioned being one, the role of women in the whiskey world. How did you experience any rejection at all, or was it hard for you? Because, for lack of a better term, whiskey has always been sort of a very male-oriented business.
No, and I always am at pains to say I had the most positive reception. I never even entertained the idea that it might be unusual that a relatively young woman, because I was in my early 30s when I entered the industry, and I was greeted with open arms. I have to say, I never experienced any negativity. I think the boys were delighted that a few women were beginning to nudge their way into their industry, because it took some of the edge off them always having to know everything about everything. And, you know, I was given so much knowledge and time from people who wanted to share that with me. And I'm very, very grateful for that. And I think it's wonderful now that we see lots of young women coming into the industry, because if we want young women to drink whiskey, you have to have young women telling them about whiskey. You have to have a woman saying, look, this was my experience of it, because it's all anecdotal. People will trust you if they see somebody that they think, oh yeah, well, she isn't a big hairy bloke in a kilt, and actually she's telling me that she finds notes of chocolate and rosiness, and do you know what, so do I. And I think it just makes the connection much easier for a woman to take it from another woman. The other thing that I always find is that men will always ask me the questions that they were too ashamed or embarrassed to ask another man for possibly loss of face. And I've had more men coming to me saying, do you know what, Annabelle, could you just answer this one thing for me? I've never understood it. You know, and Bob's your uncle. We clear it up.
And when you talk about women hearing about whiskey from other women, as you referred to, women who actually know about whiskey as opposed to, shall we say, the booth bunnies that tend to come out for events like this that wouldn't know a whiskey from a rum, from a cachaca or whatever, but it's what they're being paid to promote that night. That's where we really need to get the education point across, right?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, all of these people have their role to play, and it's very nice having decorative people, male or female, on a stand, and we work it both ways. But I just think that a little amount of knowledge goes an awfully long way, and the big difference that I've noticed in these fairs, these whiskey shows, you can hear the noise bubbling up behind us, is that the people now from 5 years ago are asking more detailed questions, and I've noticed that especially with the women. So they are managing to come to a show and find out something, taste for themselves, write their own tasting notes, and then go home and process that information, and then the next time they come to a show they know a little bit more. And if they find somebody on the stand who really does know what they're talking about, you know, I find I get drilled sometimes. I can get drilled into a corner by somebody who really wants to find out all the detail. Well, that's wonderful. That's what my role is here for.
What's the biggest misconception about Scotch whiskey?
I think it's about how you should drink it, and I love to shake that up a bit. Richard Patterson and I always have a running joke about throwing ice cubes about. My theory is that once that whiskey is in your glass, it's your whiskey. You can put ice, soda, water in it. As long as it's not a very aged whiskey, you know, we don't want to mess around with those, but have some fun with it. Drink it the way you like it. If it's hot, you want a refreshing drink. If it's cold, I want a warming drink. So it's about understanding the company you're in, the climate you're in, and the mood you're in. And then you drink the whiskey the way you want it.
And how do you drink it?
Always. I drink it neat. I drink it with water. I drink it with ice. And I've just come back from Japan, and there they drink it with soda. And that is a delicious, clean, refreshing drink. So I'm very, very flexible.
The Japanese style is called Mizuwari, and I have to admit that I haven't tried it yet. I still resist adding anything but a small amount of water to my whiskies, but I'll give it a try sometime. I did have the chance to try some interesting single malts from Bal Blair this week at a luncheon tasting with the company's sales team in New York, and let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department there. As we heard from distillery manager John McDonald last November in episode 226, 2010 marks the debut of Bal Blair's vintage bottlings in the U.S. The current lineup includes the 1997 and 1991 vintages. You'll find my tasting notes for the 1991 at the WhiskeyCast website and in the iPhone app. I'll be adding notes for the 1997 soon. The 1989 Bal Blair has been available for some time now in other markets and will be the next one sent to the U.S. It's bottled at 43% ABV. The nose has notes of cloves, orange peel, and honey. The taste carries over those same notes along with a touch of cinnamon, and the finish lingers with notes of cinnamon and clove and a slight citrusy tartness underneath. Consistency is the byword here. I'm giving the Bal Blair 1989 an 88. I also got to try the oldest Bal Blair ever released, a 1965 single cask bottled at 52.3% ABV at around 33 years of age or so. It was aged in an American oak ex-sherry cask. The nose is extremely complex. I got notes of honey, black pepper, cloves, wet campfire smoke, and a touch of pears. The taste starts off spicy with long-lasting peppery notes that fade to reveal hints of honey, licorice, and cloves with subtle traces of figs and thyme. The finish is extremely long, and by that I mean minutes, with a subtle pepperiness and a hint of licorice. Only 350 bottles were ever released, and if you get a chance to try the Bal Blair 1965, jump on it. I'm scoring it a 96. I've also been preparing for the trip to Isla by doing what else? Tasting some Isla classics. I'm planning to visit the site of the old Port Ellen distillery while I'm there, and tasted a Douglas of Drumlanrig single cask bottling of 25-year-old Port Ellen from 1982. Douglas of Drumlanrig is bottled in conjunction with the folks at Douglas Lang & Company, and it was bottled at 58.2% ABV. The nose has classic Isla notes of peat and tar, seaweed and brine. The taste is chewy and spicy with a note of black pepper that fades to reveal some lemony tartness. The finish is long and tart with a hint of smoked salmon and brine. I'm scoring it an 89. Once again, you'll find all of my tasting notes in the WhiskeyCast iPhone app sponsored by the Glen Rothes and at the WhiskeyCast website, along with links to my Twitter feed and the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2010, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.